There are times, good friends, which try even the hardy soul of a rabbi. I went to bed last night, much as you did, in the eager expectation of an intellectual treat this morning. Near 1 o'clock, my phone rang. It was Ambassador Galbraith calling me from Omaha, Nebraska. He had been speaking at the university in Lincoln, and he had spent the better part of the afternoon and the evening at the airport in Omaha, which was fog-bound and fogged in. And the last plane had just flown over. No planes had taken off and none had landed. He was there and we were here. I suggested to the ambassador that he might dictate over the phone the text of his lecture. But he said that he had intended to speak from notes and that he intended to be with us. And so as soon as he returns to his desk in Cambridge, we will be in communication and conversation, and a new date for our lecture will be scheduled. In the meantime, what does a rabbi do at 1:30 in the morning? Staring down at a blank sheet of paper on his desk, knowing that whatever he says at the service will be anticlimactic. Well, at 1:30 in the morning, you puzzle the strange bafflements of human destiny. You wonder about this mystery which is life. And so I decided that I would speak to you this morning on the theme of mystery. It's a strangely appropriate one. But when we consider the history of our people, we find an interesting fact. We think of the new year as a fall holiday, the Rosh Hashanah. But if we go back into the dim reaches of antiquity, you will find that the new year occurred in the spring, on the new moon of the month of Nisan, this month, this week. Nothing is left, really, of the ritual and the rite of this most ancient of the New Year's days of our people, save one custom only. In our synagogues, there will be read the 19th chapter of the Book of Numbers, much as it was read, lo, these millennia ago. Now, if you pick up the Bible and leaf to the 19th chapter of the fourth book, and if you read as most of us read, hot rod-like, galloping your eye down the page, you'll pass it over without noticing it. It seems to be nothing more than another of those heavily stylized, detailed accounts of how sacrifices were conducted in ancient Israel. We have no sacrifices, and frankly, we have very little interest in the techniques of the temple sanctuary. But if you read the Bible as our sages read it, with detail and with attention and with some concern for the text, you will find that this 19th chapter of the Book of Numbers is one of the most intriguing of the whole Bible. For it is a mystery which no one has ever been able to unravel. In the 19th chapter of the Book of Numbers, we are told that the priest was to bring a red heifer as a sacrifice to God, and that this red heifer was to be burnt, made into a holocaust, completely charred and cindered. And then the priests were to broom together the char and the ash, and carry them outside of the compound of the sanctuary, outside of the encampment of Israel, place them on a clean spot in a mound, and that this sacrifice was to be an act of atonement for Israel. Now we have here, obviously, some ancient magical purgation of the people. This was a symbolic ritual way for the people to become clean. And it is in many ways reminiscent of the somewhat later practice of the Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, when in the temple in Jerusalem, two goats were brought to the high priest. One was selected as a sacrifice, and the other was brought before the priest, and he placed his hands upon the shoulder blades of the animal, and he recited a ritual to this effect: "Upon thee I place my sins, upon thee I place the sins of my house, upon thee I place the sins of the whole household of Israel." And then this animal, this scapegoat, the Azazel, was driven out of the sanctuary, out of the gates of Jerusalem, into the wilderness to death. And it symbolically bore with it the guilt for which the people on the Day of Atonement had made their repentance. Now, these two ancient practices are similar in origin and similar in purpose. But the sacrifice of the red heifer is written large in paradox. For the Bible tells us that though it is a sacrifice that is to cleanse the people, those who touch the sacrifice and offer it, or those who touch the mound of dust made of the sacrifice, are rendered unclean. How does the unclean, the sacrifice, make clean, and how does the clean make unclean? That is the riddle that no one has unraveled. And the rabbi said that even the wisest of our ancestors, King Solomon, he of the legendary wisdom who was able to unravel the enigmas of the East, even King Solomon could not understand this single passage of the Bible. And they added in our midrash, "And how much does our own wisdom fall short of his?" Now I find this mysterious chapter of the Bible to be a significant one. Not, believe me, that I've ever been asked to offer a purgation sacrifice. Thank God sacrifices went out in Israel 2,000 years ago. I have a rather squeamish stomach for this kind of thing. But because it is symbolic, because it has a symbolic value to us. You know, you and I are members of a rather arrogant generation. We tend to feel that such is the maturity of our knowledge that it will soon lay bare the very skeleton of the universe. That nature's deepest and most prized and carefully preserved secret will soon be exposed in our possession. And the sacrifice of the red heifer is to the world of the spirit what the law of indeterminacy is to the world of science. A simple statement that there is a significance, a vastness, a reality in the world, in life, far beyond our comprehension, far beyond our uttermost power to understand it. Mystery. Mystery is part of the very nature of being. There are simple organisms which can neither be weighed nor measured. There are elements in the spiritual life of the man which cannot be located or exposed or scalpeled. For each mystery we uncover, another 10 mysteries are revealed to us. The world is simply not created according to our categories of thought. It is created according to a far more fundamental and majestic wisdom. Would you know God? Recognize then this majesty and this mystery. Would you know God? Look out into the world about you and see its creative might, its power which cannot be circumscribed by every talent of which the human mind possesses. For his thoughts are not our thoughts, and his ways are not our ways. Just as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are his ways higher than our ways, and his thoughts than our thoughts. Every once in a while, someone will research the religious views of scientists. They're interested to know if those who live at the frontiers of human knowledge have lost their faith or gained faith. And the sum and substance of these surveys so far has been that the scientist is very much such as you or I. Some have faith, and some are men of little faith. Some find themselves familiar within the walls of a sanctuary and at home, and others must walk alone and carve their own philosophy. Men, after all, whatever be their interests and their professions, are men, each with his own sensitivity and spiritual talent. But those who touch the living reality, these come back to us always, whether they give a deistic or a non-deistic answer, and speak of the majesty, of the miracle, of the size, of the depth of reality, of its significance, of its vastness, of its restlessness, of that which is ever elusive to human understanding. O Lord, how shall I find thee? High and hidden is thy place. Where shall I not find thee, whose glory fills all space? The heavens declare the glory of God, and the earth revealeth his handiwork. Mystery leads men to awe. And as we stand awe and reverent before the universe, we are led to acknowledge the Creator, God. Mystery leads to a second teaching. For mystery leads us to an understanding of God's law, this law, the commandment, the tradition. You and I are not only members of a rather arrogant generation, but we delight to think of ourselves as competent, as decision makers. When a judgment needs to be done, we like to believe that we lay the skeleton of the problem bare before us. We bring to mind all the possibilities, all the ramifications, and when all is laid out, we make a reasonable decision. But if we are honest with ourselves, we can enlighten only a fragment of the problem. There are always the imponderables, the unknown, that which eludes the human grasp. We stumble, we intuit, we hope. These are the real ways in which we make the fundamental human decisions. You know, when we were young, we used to believe that we knew in what the good consisted. The good was that which our parents had taught us. And as adolescents, again, we knew what the good consisted in. The good was that which our friends and peer groups agreed on. But as we became adult, we were no longer so certain. We heard of Socrates, and we recognized that the human mind could punch holes into every argument for a definition of virtue, that none was logically sound. And then we began to read the formative and seminal thinkers of our age. We read of Nietzsche, who told us that the good was that which served the use of the man of strength and of iron will, whatever the consequence to the poor and the ordinary and the simple. We read of Huxley, who told us that the good was simply that which improved the eugenic quality of the race. We read of Karl Marx, who defined the good simply as that which brought about the emergence of the proletariat, again, without thought to its consequence in the life of other individuals. We read of our own Professor John Dewey, who told us that the good was that which permitted the integration of the human being into a society. We found many of these views contradictory, most of them confusing, and we wondered and we recognized that the simplest moral decisions of life are themselves confusing. They must be made at best tentatively. We cannot be sure. You remember the shock which came the first day you walked into a great university library, and you saw the range upon range of volumes, miles upon miles of books, the inherited wisdom of the human race. You stood in mute humility. And you recognize that were you to spend the rest of your life reading, you would not have made a dent into this mountain. For every book that you completed, 100 would have been added to the catalog. Man is capable, surely. Man can enlighten, truly. But beyond the circumference of that which we can know, there is always a vastness which is unknown, uncertain, confusing, and we always must make our decisions within the framework of mystery. Well, how then do we make them? In terms of the proven, the useful. I cannot logically prove to you that to do justly and to love mercy and to walk humbly with your God is the definition of the virtuous way. I cannot prove it, but I can show to you historically that those who have done justly and loved mercy and walked humbly have added to the sum total of human happiness and have given us that which we choose to call civilization. And those who have walked arrogantly and callously and aside have ruptured the fabric of the family, strained the web of relations within the community, and added to the sum total of human anguish and human misery. And what more proof can we have? These are the eternal verities, the eternal moral commandments of the race. And when we confront mystery, these are the solid foundations on which we can build our lives and make our decisions. Mystery then leads us, if we have the heart, to God, and mystery leads us, if we have the will and the mind, to God's law. And finally, mystery leads us to an understanding of our vocation as a people. Why are we Jews? Because we were born Jews. Why should we remain as Jews? Because we have a certain pride of family, of tradition. But what use has the world of a Jewish element? We are, after all, a small minority of some 20-odd millions in the world, numbering the billions and the billions. In the scale of power, in the scale of population, we hardly tilt the indicator. What use has the world of Jews? Again, I cannot give you a logical, rational answer. But then Jewish history and man's history generally has never fit neatly into the categories of reason. There is always the mystery, that which cannot quite explain why a given people presents to civilization this given gift. How is it that these wandering Arameans who are ancestors gave to the world the vision of the one God and the one law and the one brotherhood in humanity? Were they better biologists than any other of their contemporaries in antiquity? Hardly. The science of that day, the classification of that day, seemed to show that there were legitimate differences between the races. You could see it experimentally. There were differences in pigmentation, in the coloring of the skin, in the growth of the hair, in the stature of the tribes. As men classified the tribes systematically, they seemed to show the differences between men. And between the free man and the slave, there were obviously differences. The free man was cultivated, a gentleman. The slave was a rabble, a canaille. And his children were the same oafs that he had been. And so the greatest of the biologists and the scientists of antiquity, Aristotle, knows Greeks, men, barbarians, the lesser breed without the law. And he can look on slaves only as human tools, less than mortal, less than human. Yet 800 years before, the Hebrew prophets had proclaimed, "Have we not all one Father? Hath not one God created us all?" Were our fathers then better analytic philosophers, aestheticians, and moralists? Hardly. We did not produce a mind as keen, as analytically sophisticated as Plato. And yet Moses, 800 years before Plato, argued that there must be only one law for the homeborn and for the stranger, and Plato knew of many laws. A law of large freedom for the philosopher king, a restrictive, repressive law for the slave, for the prole, for the worker, for the plebeian. Were we better theologians? The most academic and erudite theologians of ancient times were the priests of Mesopotamia and of Egypt, the priests of Marduk and of Atun Re. They were educated, they were learned, they were knowledgeable, they knew the inherited wisdom of the race, yet they were never able to break through the complicated polytheism of their world to a vision of the unity of the world and of the oneness of God. How shall we explain then the the unique gift to civilization of our people. We abhor mystery as men, and many have offered explanation. Some have argued that our contribution to civilization can be known in terms of our wilderness living. The wilderness, the desert is limitless, so the vision of the unlimited God. We were a nomadic people. We went from place to place, from tribe to tribe, and we came to know that all peoples are essentially similar. There is a rude, simple justice in the desert, one law for all peoples. Yet how shall we explain that our people alone, among the 10,000 Bedouin tribes of antiquity, broke through polytheism, broke through the slave-free standards of the ancient world and came to the vision which is enshrined in our Bible? No, there is mystery to history. There is mystery to the usefulness of the Jew in history and the usefulness of the Christian in history and the usefulness of the Greek in history and the usefulness of the Roman in history, the usefulness of the American in history. These ultimately cannot be parsed down. What then is our usefulness today? How is it that a ghettoized people, denied participation in the Renaissance and the Industrial Revolution in its early days, denied admittance to the universities of the world, how is it that this people mysteriously gave to the 20th century three of its most formative and important thinkers, Dr. Freud, Karl Marx, and Dr. Einstein? And what of our role today? Again, we cannot prove it through logic, but in the mystery there is a role. Have we not something to teach the world about the way to live in a heavily populated urban society, the concepts of welfare, of care one for the other? Have we not something to teach the world of the virtue of learning and the value of education? And perhaps fundamentally, have we not something to teach the world about the reasonableness of hope? Israel was cindered. Israel was gassed. Israel was decimated. And Israel was reborn. And in a world which is as violent and as confused as our own, do we not stand to men of goodwill the world over as the living proof that if you will it, there is a way? The words are Herzl's. That decency can triumph over greed. Peace can triumph over violence. Justice can triumph over cruelty. That man can yet have his vision of a peaceful and ordered and open and free society. It's good then to think of mystery, to think of it even in the wee hours of the morning. Why did our ancestors read this chapter full of mystery at the beginning of a new year? Well, the new year is mystery. Yet when most of us confront a new year, the uncertainty of the future, we are filled with fear and a vague trembling. We are much happier with the familiar, where we are. We don't like to dare, to brave, to adventure. Were not our ancestors telling us that there is nothing to fear in the mystery which is life? That the new year and its days are as full of promise as the old year, perhaps of more, they are fresh and clean. Mystery can be a great teacher to man. Mystery can lead us to a clearer vision of the one Creator God. And mystery can lead us to a clearer appreciation of the elemental moral law, the Ten Commandments, the Torah, the law of dignity and of community, of justice and of freedom. And that mystery can lead us to a sense of our own historical mission as a religious people, as a community dedicated to the service of God.